Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Janet Reitman, who has a book, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. Janet Reitman is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine. She covered the war in Iraq, Zimbabwe, the Duke lacrosse scandal, Haiti, childhood obesity, an MA in journalism from Columbia. Janet Reitman began this book with an article for Rolling Stone in 2007, and at that point knew very little about Scientology and learned along the way. Let me start by asking, because there's a lot of questions about this book, Inside Scientology. Scientology is noteworthy for litigation, harassment, and pressure. Have you gotten any since the publication?
That's one of those questions I can't actually comment on. But I would say that the book's in the stores, and that's about all I can say on that. Sorry about that.
There's a climate of fear around Scientology. When you were working on the book, was that in the back of your mind?
No. I've never really been afraid of this topic. I think it's probably a function of my growing up in a different era. I didn't know anything about Scientology when I started the book. I mean, I knew a little bit, but very little. And I, you know, was not really cognizant, as were, you know, honestly, most people, of the scandals and the harassment and some of the litigation that had gone on with Scientology in the 70s and the 80s. I was a child, so I really had no connection to that. And I think that the fact that I didn't have that connection enabled me to walk into this project with a much more objective and open-minded approach and without that level of fear. And I'm also just not a very fearful person to begin with. You know, I've done some really scary things in my life, so, you know, this wasn't that bad.
Do you think having gone to Iraq during the height of the troubles there might have helped you in terms of being able to handle pretty much anything?
That was scary. I was scared there. I'll admit it. I was wussy. I must say, you know, I'm very grateful to my publisher and to my my editors at Rolling Stone for being so supportive of me. And, you know, I mean that with all sincerity, because that really makes the difference for a writer of whether or not they feel like emboldened to really do great work or not. Because if you have a great publisher and great editors behind you that are 100% supportive, then you don't have as much fear. And I think that some of the people that do have fear are those who have not been as well supported as me, and that's unfortunate.
The story of Scientology breaks down into, I guess, two segments. The first is Hubbard and his life. L. Ron Hubbard was the founder of Scientology, wrote a book called Dianetics, former science fiction writer. Well, he wrote science fiction even after he became the head honcho of Scientology. He passed away, and after a power struggle, a man named David Miscavige became the leader of the Church of Scientology. That part has been covered elsewhere. What happened since Miscavige came in has not been covered elsewhere. Did you ever meet Miscavige?
No, I wanted to. I asked many, many times to meet him. I never was granted that privilege. And then he hasn't really done an interview, actually, since 1998.
I was surprised that you had so much access from the folks in Scientology. How friendly were they? What were they trying to do, do you think?
When I began this project, which originally was a magazine article, the Church of Scientology was on a public relations swing, and they were more open to journalists than they'd ever been before. That said, I had petitioned them for a long time to get certain things, and their traditional tactic, which continues to this day, is to delay and to be nice, to be gracious, and to say, we'll get back to you, or thanks, or we're working on it, or, you know, and that can go on for months or months and years or whatever. What happened with us was we were finishing the magazine piece. I was already basically talking to my colleagues and friends and people about that maybe I should do a book, because I realized I had a tremendous amount of material I wasn't going to be able to include in this gigantic magazine article that I wrote. And we went to the Church of Scientology for like sort of a last time and said, okay, one last chance. Here's some questions we have for you. We need to fact check with you. And they then turned around and said, no, wait a minute. You need to come out and visit with us, and we will give you the full-on treatment. The original invitation was for my two editors at Rolling Stone, which is not the way we do journalism, as you know. So So I went, obviously, because I was a reporter, and I wound up spending an incredible 3 full days with Mike Rinder, who is now an ex-Scientologist, or an ex, he considers himself a Scientologist. He's an ex-church official. At the time, though, he was the number 2 or 3 in the church, and he was the top chief spokesman of the church, and a very long, long-time devoted sort of true believer, and a very smart guy, actually, very articulate, smart guy. And then the second guy was his underling, a guy named Tommy Davis, who is now the spokesman of the church. So these guys spent 3 days with me, took me all over the place, took me to the international base, which is the headquarters of the International Church of Scientology. It's where the sort of inner sanctum, and which is a place that most reporters never get to see. And also went and saw lots of things that reporters do see, like the Cephalopity Center, a Narcanon clinic. You know, I went to one of their schools. I really wanted to see one of their schools. They allowed me to ask them any question in the book, and they presented their viewpoint very stridently. And it was all recorded and, you know, on tapes and whatever. And they taped it, actually, as did I. It was a really unique experience. And I recently ran into Mike Rinder, who's now out of the church, in Florida when I was doing a reading. And he was saying to me, like, he'd never, ever, no reporter had ever gotten that level of access. He'd never had that kind of an experience with somebody who just sort of spent all this time. Because, you know, you're driving around L.A. going to one place to the next place. You're stuck in traffic all the time. And so they had to sort of allow me to ask them questions, because what are they going to do? Not, you know, we're sitting there on the 10 for like an hour. I mean, so it was very it was a very interesting experience. And that was the best access ever, really.
Today, when I was going online, I looked at an interview that you did with the Village Voice, and the reporter there led me to a website, it might have been Rinder's website, called Exodus. And from what you talk about at the end of the book, there's been a huge exodus from Scientology in the past 3 years.
Yeah, that website is Jeff Hawkins' website, who is one of the main characters in my book, a really interesting person. He was the former marketing chief of the church. There has been a large exodus in the past few years, mostly due to what I think is a combination of rising prices or just extremely high prices and a really incessant need for money and insistence on money, constant phone calls to members to give money for various causes as well as pay for services and whatever. And that coupled with a really sort of punitive environment, a very punishing environment that's been existed in the church for a very long time that people are beginning to be sort of weary of. And I think that part of that weariness comes from the accessibility of information that is out there because of the internet. Scientology used to sort of censor or try to censor information just simply by telling its members to avoid certain websites or to even give them like a little program that they installed on their computers that served as a net nanny. It would, you know, filter out anything that was critical of the church. It's impossible to do that any longer with when you have not just an office computer or a home computer, but you have an iPhone. You have, all kinds of devices that can do web searches and that barrage you with information all the time. And so I think that even the membership of Scientology that used to be very shielded from criticism has been exposed to more of it. They've been curious. They've done some research. And they've recognized that some of their unhappiness is shared by many more people than they thought.
And, of course, then there's South Park and OT3, the mythology that sits behind a lot of Scientology, which we don't need to go into. Anybody could go online and discuss it. But that seemed to have created a huge dent because it opened a door that was top secret.
Yeah. I mean, I think a fundamental aspect of Scientology is that there are lots of secrets, and that the OT3 secret, which is what many people view as the creation myth. Scientologists, by the way, will deny this. So people outside of Scientology will look at it and say that's the creation myth. It's certainly a very important story. And this was something that is marketed to church members like a carrot that they're pursuing, and they have to get there. And it's called, this level is called the wall of fire. And it's, you know, there's a tremendous amount of sales pressure put on people to go to that point, to get to that point, to ascend to that level. At various times in the church's history, that pressure has been more intense than at other times. But it's something that is, you know, seen as an exalted place. So what happens is when somebody gets there and they read this story, which is really like a science fiction story and seems incredibly implausible, they get very disillusioned, they get very angry, they've spent $100,000, some of them have spent much more than that. You know, they've invested their heart and soul in all of this stuff, and they feel sort of betrayed, and they have to somehow convince themselves that this is okay. Some do, because, you know, honestly, if you're whatever religious tradition you come from, we all have mythologies. You know, I was raised Jewish. I don't believe that Moses literally parted the Red Sea. You know, I have friends who are Catholic who do not believe that Jesus Christ walked on water. Okay. You know, but you understand what the symbolism of all of that, right? So that's what a lot of people in Scientology will read some of the science fiction mythology in general and translate that into a less literal interpretation. Other people, though, go literally, you know, what the WTF moment. You know, there are some people that think that Hubbard was just really high when he wrote it. I don't think that's necessarily the case. But L. Ron Hubbard wrote this in the 60s. Don't forget, he wrote it in the late 60s.
Janet Reitman, the origins of Scientology exist in Hubbard, and when he came to L.A. after the war, he stayed at a house called the Parsonage, which was owned by a man named Jack Parsons, who was a rocket scientist. At that time, there was a 17-year-old kid there with red hair by the name of Alva Rogers, later wrote a book called Requiem for Astounding. Alva was a friend of mine, and he made the comment, which he refused to put on tape, that Hubbard, because they were both redheads, came over to him and whispered, "Alva, I'm working on something that will make P.T. Barnum look like a piker." Do you think that was Dianetics, or do you think it was just the scam he was pulling on Parsons?
I really have no idea. I've never heard that story, and I love it. And I'm so bummed I didn't know you could ask you that, get that for my book. Damn. I really don't know. I mean, that would have been 1944, and Hubbard didn't come up with Dianetics until 1950, late 1940s, 48, 49 is when he was working on it. 50 came out. One of the things that really fascinated me about that period in Hubbard's life, and that was very hard to research because these people are dead for the most part. For a guy that wrote everything down, he had very little written down in this period. There are no journals that you can find of his during this. This is kind of a dark period in his life. But the religious explosion in Los Angeles in the 30s and the 40s, which really, you know, even before that in the 20s, and there was a huge burgeoning of alternative religious movements in Los Angeles, and that coalesced very well with science and science fiction. And there were lots of sort of new science-oriented groups that were emerging and then quickly dying, and that were all focused in ways of making money. And so I can see that Hubbard would have seen that there could be financial benefit in something, in some movement, in some maybe religion or something like that. I know that he was a guy that was very clearly out to make his name, make his mark. I think he really wanted to be somebody with a capital S, you know, and I think that, you know, I don't think that would have been what he was doing necessarily on Parsons. I think it was something larger, and I don't know whether it was Dianetics or something else, but it was something probably. That's a great story.
I spoke with Harlan Ellison, who told me that during, I guess, late 40s, early 50s, when he was still a fan, Hubbard would go around to different parties of science fiction writers. And what Harlan told me is that Fred Pohl tells a similar story, but Fred was not at the party Harlan was at, in which Hubbard went around talking to people about what would be the best way to start a religion. And it was actually Harlan's theory that this came about because Lester Del Rey, who was another science fiction writer, had been a child evangelist and was telling everybody about how you could make money in religion. But, of course, this is all speculation.
I love this stuff. It's fascinating.
Well, anyway, it seems that Hubbard somehow convinced John W. Campbell that he was for real. The early Dianetics seems to be mostly a case of discovering biofeedback.
Yeah, I guess. You know, I look at it in a less scientific and more sociological way. When I look at early Dianetics and why I think it took off, because it was a genuine fad in this country for a year. 1950 was the really peak of the Cold War, and we were entering Korea, and we were still feeling a lot of the residuals from World War II, which included a lot of vets coming back with PTSD that went unrecognized because we didn't even know what that was at the time, right? It was shell shock, I think is what we called it in that era. And there was no area for these people to get any kind of help at all, except for psychiatry, which was a very limited field. There were very few psychiatrists in this country, and they were not in any parts of the country that were not on the coasts, really. They were in the major, you know, D.C., New York, L.A., Chicago, San Francisco. And if you're, you know, a suffering World War II veteran, and you return, and you're from, you know, Duluth, Minnesota, and you come home, what are you going to do? So Bert Hubbard writes this book, Dianetics, which promises that you can essentially heal yourself of your problems with a friend or with a partner, with some, and for free. You just read a book and it shows you these techniques and you can do it. It's very early self-help. It's one of the earliest forms of self-help. And it was incredibly appealing to people at a time of actual need, of like sort of, there was a national trauma that was happening here. And the book hit a chord in the same way that Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking hit a chord. It also had a scientific component, which made it very appealing to people that were obsessed with science, which we all were in the mid-century. The science was booming, you know, rocket science in particular, physics, you know, anything electronic, that was all very new and very cool to lots of people. Everybody was really intrigued by this. And so Hubbard, you know, attached this essentially psychological idea to science. There really isn't much science in Scientology. I mean, there's no technology, real technology, despite the fact that they call it technology in Scientology.
And Dianetics turned into Scientology because he lost the rights to the use of Dianetics.
He lost the rights to the use. He was a really bad businessman. He basically created something that was so successful, he lost control of it. You know, he was a bad businessman. He spent too much money. He didn't manage his creation very well. He didn't know how to, you know, how to take it to the next level. And it bombed. So he had to reinvent himself. And what was happening was that people who were doing Dianetics were having past life experiences in their auditing and their counseling. They were going back to relive traumas, which is what you do in Scientology counseling. And they were going way back, and they were all of a sudden like 50 lifetimes before, and they were Mark Anthony or they were, you know, whoever. And so he said, this is spiritual, this is religion, Scientology. He rebranded, and it worked.
Well, the question, of course, that goes back to what Harlan Ellison had said about searching for precepts of a religion would seem to indicate that he had religion on his mind all along. And yet, from your book, Janet Reitman, it appears that it was kind of like serendipitous that he came up with it as a religion because he could get the tax write-offs, too.
You know, I think it's really debatable whether he had religion on his mind all along. I'm admitting here that you, dude, have some pretty good sources that I was not. You have an edge. You have a friendship with somebody that I just don't know and who's no longer with us. And some of this is hearsay. And I got to prove everything in my book. So I couldn't prove that L. Ron Hubbard was, you know, intending on creating a religion all along. I didn't feel comfortable saying that. I do think that culturally and sociologically, it would have totally fit in to the mindset of the guy and the mindset of the times, because that was like there were religions popping up every day that people were trying to make money off of. Religion sold. Same way that religion sells today, really. Religion really sold.
The question then is, how did he go from being a bad businessman to being such a good marketer?
I don't know. I mean, he was a great marketer all along. It's a really good question. I never could figure out, actually. Nobody I ever interviewed was able to explain to me how he went from being a sort of obsessive spent, you know, he spent a tremendous amount of money. It wasn't like he was living high on the hog, but he was just, you know, traveling around the country being like a P.T. Barnum character, you know, promoting Dianetics and touring the world with it in a way, touring Europe and touring England and touring the U.S., to, you know, having, you know, a bankrupt organization and then rebranding it and turning it into something that was much shrewder. I mean, he somehow absorbed a shrewder business sense.
He also stumbled into something that worked. People felt that they got something out of Scientology, which itself is pretty extraordinary. I mean, he took all of these elements, put them together, and suddenly people are feeling better because of it. That's pretty astonishing.
Yeah, I don't discount L. Ron Hubbard. You know, the other thing, too, is he had a lot of help. He had a lot of people that went to work with him. He had a lot of young people who went to work with him who were researchers, who were really interested in science, who were young engineers. He had, like, test subjects. He was not a guy that created this all on his own. He did it with a lot of other people. He later would claim total control and responsibility. He was very afraid always of losing control. And so, you know, and this is based
makes
on his...
Sense.
It makes sense, you know, right? He ultimately would claim ownership over everything. And even later, his followers would claim, like, total ownership over... I mean, they would make it as if he was God. But early on, he had lots of help. It was a very active sort of hive environment. It was in England at the St. Hill Manor, this English manor in Sussex, where they created a lot of early Scientology, as most of the core Scientology practices and teachings were created. And it was done in conjunction with lots of people.
The entire story from the early auditing to being clear to the bridge to total freedom, that whole thing. How did that come about? I mean, was that piecemeal or did it sort of present itself from the beginning?
I think it evolved over time, but to be honest with you, that's something I didn't focus on very much in my book. Scientology was always predicated in an idea of ascended knowledge, increased enlightenment. I think over those years in the early 60s, he and others kind of worked on all these ways of these processes, as they call them, to bring a person greater and greater and greater enlightenment, which became the bridge to total freedom. The OT levels, which are the levels that everybody talks about, those were designed in the 60s. That came much later, in the late 60s. That came much later.
In reading the entire story of Inside Scientology, there were ethical questions, of course, about Hubbard because he was a scam artist earlier in his life. There's something called ethics within Scientology, mm-hmm. but it struck me in reading the entire book, from the early days of Hubbard, later on to Miscavige, that there's a lack of ethics in a way. There's nothing in Scientology about being a good person that I can see in your book, and there's a lot about the ends justifying the means.
Yeah, I think that is actually the crux of, in certain ways, it's a crux of Scientology's external practices, and also it's probably its greatest failing. Is this idea of the greatest good, which is it's a very common idea that we all understand as what's in the greatest good of family or of our community or of our country. Or in Scientology, it's what's in the best interests of the group, and we need to serve that group no matter what, and it doesn't matter what it will cost. You know, the ends can justify the means, you know, sort of in any means necessary. And that has legitimized a lot of very questionable behavior since Scientology's founding.
That may be something that goes back to a gap in Hubbard himself. But who knows?
I don't know. I think it goes back to his paranoia and that he was a deeply paranoid. I mean, you know, L. Ron Hubbard was an only child who lived in a fantasy world for most of his life. He had very few close friends and connections all through his life. I mean, he wrote these fantasy stories and lived in that kind of a world. But when he created an actual world, a Scientology world, which is its own world, you know, he created a system where he was always going to be secure, always going to be safe. He would always have a community around him that was loyal to him. He would never be betrayed. He would never be embarrassed. It was a very, you know, it's psychologically, if you look at it, it's like he created like this warm snuggly for himself. It didn't really turn out that way. But all those rules that he came up with were to preserve this institution so that he would never be exposed.
There's a poignant moment toward the end of his life. You describe someone talking about him as under the guise of being an old uncle in a trailer park or living in a trailer, maybe a big trailer, wandering around outside in his pajamas. Poignant and sad at that point because he'd kind of dug himself a hole.
Yeah, he became a sort of a sad old man at the end of his life. He became a Howard Hughes character, you know? And, I mean, some people will say he was sharp to the end. Other people will say he was daft for, like, 20, you know, 15 years or 10 years or 5 years or whatever it is. Like, I mean, you hear so many different stories. I know one person that worked on that ranch with him and said he was sharp till the end. You know, other people say he was nuts for 2 years. I look at him, he looks like he was Howard Hughes.
Well, Janet Reitman, one thing that you don't talk much about in the book, and it may be because you couldn't get any generalized information, Hubbard's view towards sex was very much the view of a man born, 1911?
Yeah.
He found masturbation and gay sex and sex before marriage, all of them to be, quote, perversions. This is Catholic Church stuff.
It's totally Catholic. It's so Catholic, isn't it? It's crazy.
And did you find, how did gay people deal with being, particularly second and third generation, being inside Scientology?
I don't know anybody of the second and third generation who are gay. But I do know a person who joined Scientology who was gay and who didn't want to be gay. And he was dying to not be gay. And he went all the way to the very top of the bridge, hoping that at some point they would cure him of being gay, and ultimately he was still gay at the end of it, and he sued them.
The story is about Cruz being gay and being in Scientology.
Cruz is straight. I did ask. I have never heard, despite all the rumors, not a single human being I met who has ever been in Scientology or knows Cruz has ever said to me that he's gay or bi or hasn't even a hint of it. Nothing.
I was pretty shocked, actually, by the story of how Miscavige broke up the Kidman-Cruz relationship. That's pretty stunning.
It is stunning, and I think that it speaks to something that is really a unique friendship that they have, an incredible marketing juggernaut. I felt that Scientology, one of the things about Scientology in the past 25 years, which is what I really focus a lot on, is how it went from being this sort of wacky, crazy, new agey, culty thing that criminal culty thing that people all knew about or heard about or were weirded out by, into being like a mainstream, legitimized, legally legitimized, tax exempt religion and marketing operation, which sells very effectively aspects of self-improvement and self-help under a spiritual guise, using high-profile people to do it. And Tom Cruise was a guy who was groomed from the age of 25 years old when he joined the church to be that guy. He was a unique character. He was somebody that came into Scientology already a star. David Miscavige, who had almost no experience at all with the outside world but loved movies, was really, really obsessed with Cruz. And he saw Cruz as a kind of compadre. They're very similar types of people. They're both kind of macho guys. They're both very focused, very intense human beings. They're the same height. They're about the same age. And so Miscavige befriends Cruz and lives a bit vicariously through Cruz. And then Cruz looks up to Miscavige, who's, you know, treating him like a god. And Cruz, of course, is loving this. Cruz is he's an actor. And he's the biggest movie star in the world. And he is treated by the Church of Scientology as if he is at the time, became the biggest movie star in the world. He's still regarded by the church as the biggest movie star in the world, which isn't true anymore. But he became this engine of salesmanship. And it's an interesting phenomenon because it was really the realization of what L. Ron Hubbard would have wanted. L. Ron Hubbard wanted celebrities to promote the church. He wanted Scientology to be disseminated, as he put it, everywhere, and thought that high-profile people would be a way to do it, which makes tremendous sense. But he never was successful at getting any of these people to do it because Scientology itself was so flawed. It had so many problems. There was all this legal stuff. There were all these scandals. After Hubbard died, Miscavige is a very shrewd tactician. He kind of cleaned things up.
He did a huge purge at that point.
He purged everybody who could be viewed as culpable in anything criminal. Got rid of him. He also got rid of everybody who was close to L. Ron Hubbard. And so he consolidated his power. Even while Hubbard was alive, he was working to create a much tighter management structure, a better corporate structure, that would hide money and hide spheres of influence and make it much harder to penetrate Scientology. It's a very, very Byzantine structure and system.
It seems from, talking to all of the high muckamucks who left, you got an insight into what Miscavige was like, including this bizarre game of musical chairs in which all of the leaders of Scientology are fearful they will be thrown out of the organization if they don't grab the next chair. That sort of craziness reminded me of, like, a leader of Turkmenistan. It reminded me of maybe, you know, Mugabe, who you did a report on, except there's no execution.
Mugabe would never go down to that level. Mugabe is too sophisticated for that one, I'm sorry to say. But yeah, no, to me it was like, I was like, this is just a bizarre, I thought of it as like, you know, the sort of forced confessions that people would go through, which are even more horrifying. The musical chairs incident is a very bizarre incident, but there are others that were just, you know, getting a large number of staff people in Scientology on this base together and forcing them and accusing them of crimes and getting having these people stand up and accuse one another. I mean, that's just straight out of, you know, the communist, you know, and Maoist systems.
There's a line from one of your interviews where you say, Scientology has a policy called ethics, a way of behavior that reinforces constant self-analysis and confession and self-monitoring. And I kept thinking, that's Chinese communism.
Yeah, it is. That's the way it is structured, particularly in the C organization, which is the management structure. The thing about Scientology is there are many layers of it. So the most rigorous self-analysis, confession, self-monitoring, especially self-monitoring, that goes on most intensely when you're talking about management. The average person is not self-monitoring to that extent.
And there's also this constant confession. It's recorded, which leads to the idea of blackmail.
Yeah. Well, that's the issue that people have with the celebrities is that, well, what are they saying in their auditing sessions? And is that being held over their heads? My answer to that is always that it's not just them, it's everybody. Anybody who does Scientology, who confesses anything, which everybody does, particularly their deviance. You know, everybody has deviant, quote-unquote deviant acts, right? Errant, whatever, thought. That stuff you confess the same way that you would in a Catholic confessional. And it's recorded, it's kept in a file. It could theoretically be used against you. Scientology will say it absolutely does not use this against you, but that's wrong. They do. And you can see that, the proof of that, in that when certain defectors, as they would call them, certain former officials left Scientology and began to speak out against them recently, in the past few years, the Church of Scientology released their private, you know, excerpts from their auditing sessions, where they confess to whatever, having, you know, negative thoughts about David Miscavige, a leader, or committing adultery, or whatever, having some, you know, they were something that showed them not to be perfect individuals, but it was private, you know, personal information, and they released it to the press. This is actually what spurred Paul Haggis to leave the church. Just one of the reasons why he left Scientology was because of this, because it's something that is very sacred. It's like any Catholic, you know, imagine, thinks that what they tell their priest is sacred. It's not going to go anywhere. It's like certainly everybody that talks to whoever their minister or rabbi is, you think that that's between you and them and God. Scientologists are the same. They believe that this is personal. When they see that the church actually will and does use this, that can be very, very shocking to them.
In talking about someone like Miscavige, is even talking about him at this point kind of a problem for me to, you know, in terms of litigation? I mean, I don't know. I mean, anybody who discusses Scientology winds up getting concerned.
I think that's ridiculous. Okay. I just truly think this is ridiculous. I'm a huge believer in free speech, and I come from a free speech civil rights background. My father was a top executive with the ACLU for 40 years, and I grew up with this in my cranium, my DNA, that we have freedom of speech and of thought and of belief and of practice in this country. And I certainly do. And we also have freedom of the damn press. And I do. I get very, very irritated with people, including critics of Scientology, who, you know, allow themselves to be intimidated. I mean, if you are being harassed, and I'm very serious about this, go to the damn police and get the police to do something. There is legal recourse in this country. You do that. I mean, do your research, do your homework, make sure that you have your facts straight. Don't slander someone. There's no libel in anything that I write. I haven't slandered anyone or libeled anyone. And you're not slandering anybody by talking about them, so why should you be afraid? I have absolutely no tolerance for it.
Janet Reitman, many people have left the church, and there's now something called the Association of Independent Scientologists, AIS. Is that another church, or is it just a whole bunch of people?
It's funny, they've formed an association now. It's a movement of people. I see them as the independent Scientology movement. I don't know to what level they've incorporated. I don't, actually. But it is an organization of people led by a guy named Marty Rathman, who used to be the number two in the church, Mike Rinder works with, and Mike Rinder was number three when Marty was there. What they're about is doing Scientology outside of the construct of the organized church. This is not new. This is something that also happened in the 80s by a guy named David Mayo, who had been an auditor of L. Ron Hubbard's, a very top official, big deal official in the church, was purged, decided, unlike many others, he wasn't going to take it. He had come up with a lot of these techniques. He was going to take them, and he was going to do them, and he was going to start a center in Santa Barbara, and he was going to have people come there. He took his mailing list, a gigantic mailing list, and said, come join me. A lot of people did. Scientology was extremely angry at this, and they shut him down. They intimidated him, harassed him, they sued him. They shut him down. They're trying to do the same to this new group, especially this leader, this new leader, Marty Rathbun, who kind of positions himself as the Martin Luther of Scientology. I don't know whether they'll be successful in this one as they were in the last one.
Well, they've got so many high people from the organization now.
Don't forget, they had a lot of high people from the organization in the 80s. There were a lot of top people that were purged. All those top executives were fired, basically, or left. So it's a similar turnover. But what you have now that is sort of pushing this movement, powering this movement, is the internet and the accessibility of information. You can't just say these officials are what they call squirrels. It's their terminology. You can't just say they're defectors, they're apostates, they're evil, they're traitors. You can't just say that and leave it like that, because there's a tremendous amount of information that backs up what these people are saying. Where in the 80s, you could say they're traitors, and what are you going to do? There was no way to you could spend a year in the library doing microfiche research, maybe. But there was no instant, accessibility to that information, and there weren't these kinds of groups that were this well knitted together that we have now since we have these, web groups and we have the internet. So it's a really different time.
The current chair of the Pacifica Foundation is a man named Ken Aaron, who is an ex-Scientologist. His wife, Grace Aaron, is the former acting executive director of Pacifica. Apparently, Grace knew Hubbard in the 80s. She was probably part of that earlier purge. Uh-huh. But they're right now in the center of this, the people who run this radio station. Those of us, who watch this, should we be paranoid about them or not? They still say they believe in the precepts of L. Ron Hubbard.
I don't think you should be paranoid. It's acts and deeds. It's ideas versus your acts and deeds. And I think you can believe whatever you want to believe. It's like saying, well, so-and-so is a very religious Muslim. Should we be paranoid of him? Because, he still believes in Allah. So did Osama bin Laden. I'm one of those people that says you have to put things into context, and there's a difference here, and that, if you believe in some of the writings of L. Ron Hubbard, go ahead and believe in them. If you believe that L. Ron Hubbard's techniques work for you, fantastic if it works for you. If you believe that you're going to take those teachings and revolutionize the planet and take over the world and make, somehow by whatever means necessary, force the world to conform to a Scientology worldview, even if that means infiltrating secular systems and to do it, that I would have a problem with. That practice is something that is what people have problems with. And if you're going to punish everybody around you for not adhering to the system and force them to disconnect from their families and force them to, live lives that feel uncomfortable to them, that's something that you might have a problem with. But if you just believe that you're personally on a spiritual path and L. Ron Hubbard is your guru, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I think that smart thinking, intelligent people can make a, can see the difference. And if they run this, I didn't know that they were the head of the Pacifica Foundation. My gosh, I really didn't know that. But they're letting me be on the show.
Well, they don't know.
They don't know?
No, they don't.
We'll find out.
I'll find out if I'm suddenly thrown off the air. Changing the subject completely to reportage in the last couple minutes we have, mm-hmm. There's a quote in an interview, and I think it's a significant one that you made. The best lesson I was ever taught by Jan Wenner at Rolling Stone was to cut out any prejudicial language from anything I write. The material speaks for itself. When you look at the mainstream media today, how much do you think people are following that precept?
In newspaper reporting, I think newspapers are still a wonderful institution, and I read the New York Times, I read the Wall Street Journal, I read the Washington Post, the LA Times. These are solid newspapers that do their best, and I think that where we're seeing more opinion is coming in more and more in, obviously, in cable news and in television, and that's where a lot of people get their information from. On the internet, there's a lot of editorializing going on in, on websites, not a tremendous amount of editing. Any writer who's out there listening will probably agree with me on this, or at least understand where I'm coming from, but editors are desperately needed, and writers are not editors. You know, the great advice that I got from Jan Wenner to cut out the prejudicial language, to allow people's stories to speak for themselves, those are the words of a great editor. That's the advice that any great writer does not give themselves. They have their own thoughts. And I think one of the biggest problems we have right now in journalism is that editors are not being taken as seriously. They're being fired. They're being marginalized. Younger, less experienced people are coming in and doing a lot of wonderful work, but they're also doing some of that work without a lot of training, and it shows.
You said before that Mugabe is far too sophisticated. How do you view someone like Mugabe?
Robert Mugabe is, you know, is his mid-80s. He's a very dapper man. He has his suits tailored for him on Savile Row. He's everything is best spoke. He's a very, very complicated figure. Very complicated. Talk about a tactician and a strategist. He is supreme. I'm not covering the current situation in Zimbabwe, but he's still holding on. He's the last African strongman standing, essentially. He really is. Even Gaddafi is gone, you know. I mean, he's hanging on probably by his little pinky nail.
Janet Reitman, are you pretty much done with Scientology at this point?
Yes.
Yeah. What are you working on now?
I am working on, I'm trying to understand the impact of the evangelical right on our politics, which is a topic well covered, but I'm trying to explore other angles of it. And I'm stuck in my writer's block mode, so that's all I can say on it.
And, of course, it would appear that the Tea Party, which was once called libertarian, is becoming more and more evangelical.
Yeah, like T-evangelicals. T-evangelicals. I love that word. I think somebody else, I think somebody at the New Republic actually came up with that term. Thank you. I'm going to use it. I love it. The T-evangelicals. It's kind of when I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by Rick Perry and his... I went to his prayer meeting in Houston. I've spent a lot of time lately with prayer warriors and spiritual warriors, learning about them. And it's a completely different mindset, and just like Scientology is, and it's having a big impact on our culture and on our politics.
You've been listening to an interview with Janet Reitman, whose book is titled Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.